You're listening to LawPod UK from the creators of the UK Human Rights Blog. It's a podcast that discusses developments across all aspects of civil and public law in the United Kingdom. All the comments are current at the time of podcast publication. LawPod UK is produced by the barristers at 1 Crown Office Row and is presented by Rosalind English.
Today I'm talking to Conor Monaghan, one of the regular contributors to our human rights blog. Earlier this summer, Conor attended the annual conference of the Administrative Law Bar Association. The theme this year was how international law impacts on individual rights. Does it have a strong influence, or any influence at all? At the moment when we are contemplating our withdrawal from the European Union, this isn't the ivory tower discussion that it may have once been. So, Conor, do international lawyers and domestic lawyers simply occupy different universes?
Yes. I think that, leaving the European Convention aside, public lawyers can sometimes believe that public international law has very little influence on their work. But really, the theme of the conference was that the influence of international law is extensive, and we ought not to underestimate it. And the best evidence really for this was given by Lord Lloyd Jones, the Supreme Court judge, in his talk. And he focused on Belharge and Straw. And you might remember this case. If not, Mr. Belharge and his wife had alleged that the UK assisted their rendition to Libya, a country which isn't exactly renowned for its human rights record. And they said the UK conspired in and assisted their torture, inhuman and degrading treatment. And Theresa May actually apologised for that action in May. And the case, as it happens, went up to the Supreme Court. But in the Court of Appeal, Lord Dyson made a comment which I think is really worth reading. And he said, "A fundamental change has occurred within public international law. We now have a system which includes the regulation of human rights by international law, a system of which individuals are rightly considered to be subjects." So essentially he's saying the rights of individuals are as much affected by domestic law as international law. And I think secondly, as the Attorney General for Northern Ireland pointed out, Article 31 of the Vienna Convention essentially requires account to be taken of international law. In fact, I think domestic public lawyers and international public lawyers don't really live in different universes, even if occasionally they may think so.
But presumably, in the area of human rights, obviously, the Vienna Convention is relevant. But if you're having a neighbour dispute or any other kind of private law dispute, we can't be looking at the vast array of conventions and treaties that have been agreed between sovereign states that may or may not have some relevance to the subject at hand. Perhaps you could just give us very briefly what was involved in this particular case.
So in that case, the current situation in Northern Ireland with regard to abortion rights is quite restrictive, and essentially abortion is largely criminalised. And so what happens is many people have to go over to England in order to try and have a private abortion, and that involves a lot of distress, and of course it's very expensive. And so in this particular case, the Northern Ireland Human Rights Commission challenged the compatibility of the law with various parts of the ECHR in order to try and change the situation. And in fact, they failed, but there were interesting dissenting judgments in there and important constitutional issues were raised.
So this is a case that would very much be in the frame in terms of other international rights instruments because it involved the European Convention on Human Rights. So that shows that the reach of international law is significant when a regional convention such as the European Convention of Human Rights is in the frame. But what if it isn't?
I think the point is that unincorporated international law is generally used to help inform interpretations of the ECHR. And so although it might not be directly invoked, unincorporated treaties can still inform interpretations. And specifically, Lady Hale and Lord Carr said the ECHR should be interpreted in light of generally accepted international law in many cases. So they can be affected in that respect.
And there's this long-standing principle that all legislation, in the absence of express words to the contrary, are presumed to be in accordance with international law.
And so there are these three ways: the interpretation of ECHR rights, the aid to statutory interpretation, and a more general development of the common law.
Before we go further down the common law route, I'm very interested in the topic of human trafficking and modern slavery. It's a horrible subject, and our modern law hasn't kept up with it, and we've had to suddenly kind of dig out our old rules on prohibition of slavery and so on. Could you tell us a little bit about that and how that was discussed?
Yes, well, unfortunately, it seems that domestic law is sometimes not quite in step with international law, and maybe that lends some credence to this idea that domestic public lawyers are in a different universe from public international lawyers. And Ms. Liu from Garden Court Chambers actually spoke on the subject. She noted that in the case of R&B, which unfortunately has nothing to do with the music genre, the court stated obiter that the duties that arise from Article 4 of the European Convention of Human Rights mustn't be allowed to increase inexorably. And so in relation to that case, it suggested, and this is slightly complicated, I'm afraid, but Article 17 of a 2011 directive requires victims of human trafficking to be given access to a victim compensation scheme. But they held this doesn't equate to sufficient access. And so that meant the protection offered by EU law for victims, we might suggest, is not quite as strong as one might expect.
It's complicated, isn't it? Because there's Article 4 of the European Convention, and then there's another convention on human trafficking.
The appellants in that case were essentially trying to argue Article 4 of the European Convention of Human Rights lent a certain bent onto Article 17 of this directive. And so taken together, they said they had to be given sufficient access to this victim compensation scheme. But the court said, we're rejecting that argument, and instead, it doesn't have to equate to sufficient access. Mere access is sufficient, because these duties arising from Article 4 of the European Convention of Human Rights mustn't be allowed to inexorably increase.
All sorts of interesting questions arise regarding the rights of people who've been illegally trafficked into this country. Say they're wanting to pursue other claims, such as unfair dismissal or discrimination. The courts are still able to say, well, they're here illegally, so the illegality is, as it were, undermines their rights to make civil claims in other areas.
Yeah, there's a directive, that's the problem.
So slavery and human trafficking is a specific example of where it's pretty essential that domestic courts look to international conventions and other laws. But more generally, in more principled terms, did you find that there was much agreement between speakers at the conferences about whether it's a strong influence or a weak influence?
No, in fact, there was very strong disagreement. The main dispute was between Ms. Gallagher, QC, and Mr. Larkin, the Attorney General for Northern Ireland. And it really centred on Lord Wilson's comments in the case of A&B. As it happened, actually, this case also concerned abortion rights in Northern Ireland, but it was with a slightly different twist from the Northern Ireland abortion case. So here, the appellant, a UK citizen who lives in Northern Ireland, argued that the Secretary of State's failure to provide her with an abortion free of charge was unlawful. And this appeal was also dismissed. And Lord Wilson, who gave the leading judgment, considered various international conventions, such as the UN Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women. But he felt they didn't really support the appellant's submission. And he described these conventions using a really wonderful metaphor, saying they added background colour, but that the appellants need material of a far more vivid hue to succeed. So the debate then was this: do Lord Wilson's comments mean, as Mr. Larkin was saying, that really conventions don't matter all that much when we interpret convention rights, i.e. European Convention of Human Rights? Or is Lord Wilson actually saying, as Ms. Gallagher argued, that conventions are important, but that in this particular case, the authority just wasn't strong enough? Now, I must admit that having read the judgment and reading Lord Wilson's words in context, I'm personally inclined to agree with Ms. Gallagher, but one could argue it either way. First of all, the different authorities weren't clear enough. And second of all, the impact is much debated, as you suggested in your opening. So to advance an argument which is in large part based on these international conventions and arguing that they should direct the court's interpretation of the ECHR in a certain way is quite tough, and accordingly it didn't work in this particular case. But if we take the line that Ms. Gallagher is suggesting, then it is entirely possible that in other cases, reading the ECHR in line with these conventions could produce a quite different reading and could actually succeed.
It often feels to me when I'm reading judgments that the longer a judgment or judge goes on about this or that international convention, the weaker the argument is. Because why would you have to reach for so many other instruments of law in order to make your case?
Precisely. Yes, precisely.
We've talked about the presence of non-national law. I use my words carefully. Now we're looking at reversing out of some of these laws in the form of departure from the European Union. And I just want to quote Lord Mansey's words from a case in 2015, where he said, quotes, "We must view the United Kingdom as independent, Parliament as sovereign, and European law as part of domestic law because Parliament has so willed." Will the departure from the European Union revert us to a dualistic position where national law is here, international law is out there, and these two are basically separated?
Yes, I think that's the natural conclusion to draw. So domestic lawyers and international lawyers might be thinking, well, perhaps we don't live in separate universes at the moment, but we will do very soon. But interestingly, Professor Young, who's a professor of public law at Cambridge, suggested Brexit would probably not cause rights to be lost in the UK in the way that we might assume. And there are four different arguments that she put forward. First, the Court of Justice of the European Union will continue to have an influence on domestic law. And this is because Section 6 of the EU Withdrawal Act states that courts or tribunals may have regard to such decisions if they think it's appropriate. And that includes decisions that are made after exit day. So there will still be some influence. And second, she argued that the fundamental rights enshrined in the Charter of Fundamental Rights will probably not disappear. And although Section 5 of the Withdrawal Act states the Charter will no longer be part of domestic law, part of that splitting of universes, paragraph 106 of the explanatory notes says those underlying rights and principles will also be converted into UK law. So, arguably, that means that lawyers will still be able to use case law in which those general principles were referred to. The third way is the Marleysing effect. And as we probably know, that requires member states to interpret national legislation in line with EU law so far as possible. And if that continues, it means the general principles of EU law could still have a significant impact on the interpretation of domestic law, even if we're still not part of the European Union. And fourth is the most radical idea, which we would call perhaps the New Zealand solution. And in Taylor, the New Zealand High Court made a declaration of inconsistency with the New Zealand Bill of Rights Act 1990. And Professor Young from Cambridge posited whether the same approach could actually be adopted by UK courts in relation to these general principles that are expressed in the Charter. But I have little doubt that a number of these arguments will be put forward in courts in cases to come, so we can look forward to the result of those.
It certainly in our adversarial system, there's always going to be a pushback against these arguments. So you may be arguing on behalf of your client, relying on the Marleysing effect, but it'll be completely open to the other side to say Marleysing no longer applies. That was then, now is now.
I think the third and fourth are the most questionable out of her propositions, but I think certainly the first two points that the CJEU will continue to have an influence and the
Charter will still continue to have an influence are very strong points. And so actually, perhaps there won't be this sudden loss of rights after all.
So that's European Union law. And what were the delegates saying about the future of the European Convention on Human Rights as incorporated by the Human Rights Act after Brexit?
Yes, well, the talk of leaving the ECHR has died down in the last couple of years. The Conservative Party has dropped it from their manifesto, for example. But the advocacy director at Liberty suggested that leaving the convention, the European Convention, is a distinct possibility. As she points out, some senior Conservatives still support the idea, including Dominic Raab, the Brexit Secretary. And in addition, one ought not to underestimate the number of voters that thought leaving the EU meant leaving the convention. And so, in her view, the effect of leaving the convention when combined with Brexit would be significant. But in that respect, at least, Professor Feldman from Cambridge disagreed with the advocacy director at Liberty. He argued that the Human Rights Act is quite weak anyway. And he described the system of remedies available under the Human Rights Act as a non-remedy masquerading as a remedy, which I think is quite a nice phrase. And he suggested that a system of damages has also not been properly developed. He gave various reasons for that, but essentially they are historical. And so as a result, his controversial view was that repealing the Human Rights Act as it stands would have very little impact on individual rights. So that's something to mull over.
Well, if anybody listening to this wants to read a little bit more about the conference or see the conference's papers, Connor's three blog posts on the ALBA conference are up on the UK Human Rights blog, and you'll be able to find out a lot more about what was discussed. Thank you, Connor, so much for coming on this podcast, and look forward to hearing from you again.
Right, it was a pleasure. See you soon.
LawPod UK is presented by Rosalind English and produced by One Crown Office Row. For more editions of LawPod UK, you can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and recommend us to a friend.